Welcome to the Ithaca Radio Hour, a weekly program of news, views, and events in our area. I'm your host, John Illingworth. We begin tonight's show with a report on military recruiters, schools, and the law, as our youth producer, Emily Shumway, interviews a high school official, a school board member, and a parent about the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. This week's show features two pieces on the rights of farm workers in the U.S. First, the struggle for just wages and working conditions for tomato pickers in Immokalee, Florida. And second, an opinion piece by Marty Luster on the rights of agricultural workers in New York State. In the second part of tonight's show, we hear part two of our interview with Joan Beaucaire, expert on the religious right's disproportionate influence on U.S. domestic and foreign policies. Stay tuned till the end for this week's calendar of area events. In 2001, the U.S. Congress passed the No Child Left Behind Act. One aspect of the bill requires school districts to provide names and addresses of high school students to military recruiters upon request. Local producer Emily Shumway explored how the Ithaca City School District and parents are responding to the new requirements.
A couple of weeks ago, there was some confusion among local parents and students about the requirements of the No Child Left Behind Act. Rumors were spreading that a provision in it gave high school students names and telephone numbers to military recruiters without the consent of their parents. Being a high school-age student myself, I decided it was important to get to the bottom of this, so I got in touch with Craig Evans, the assistant to the superintendent of the Ithaca City School District, and asked him to explain this new policy.
The No Child Left Behind Act is huge and all-encompassing of all our educational programs in the country and in our state and district, but the part that we're discussing is military recruiters' access to student information, and by law, we are required to provide directory information to military recruiters if they ask for it, as well as offer access to them on campus if we offer other post-secondary programs access as well. And basically, that's not a lot different from what we've already done. The Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act requires us to allow our directory information, which our district defines as name, address, and phone number, to colleges and other secondary programs unless parents opt out of that or students opt out of that. This additional piece relates to that in terms of we plan to release names, addresses, and phone numbers of our juniors and seniors at Ithaca High School and ACS to military recruiters because we offer those same pieces of information to other postgraduate programs after high school, unless parents opt out. We will be sending through the mail a letter outlining this new part of the NCLB and giving parents or guardians or students a chance to opt out. If they sign and return that letter, we will not release information to military recruiters.
Because the No Child Left Behind Act is federal law, the district is unable to challenge it without the risk of losing all federal funding. Jeff Furman of the Ithaca City School Board recognizes this. But he also points out the backwards approach the act is taking in regards to privacy. He says that it forces parents to actively protect their children's information from being handed over to military recruiters.
Because if you believe in the right to privacy, you shouldn't have to protect it each time by writing something to say, I wish to continue my right to privacy, you know. We wish to continue our right to freedom of speech. We wish to continue our right to freedom of assembly. You shouldn't have to continue to say that you want to maintain that. It would seem to me that you should have had it the other way around, which is to say they can't get the rights to the names and information unless there's a written correspondence giving out that information.
While parents need to return a letter this year in order to opt out, the school district is already making plans for next year that should ease the process for all involved.
Now, as it stands, we provide an opportunity for families to opt out of any release of information, directory information, which is name, address, and phone number, as part of our opening of school activity. And we'll just include next year the military recruiter part of that as well and do it all at once versus a separate letter.
A burden as it may be, parents are receiving these letters. I spoke to Linda Farthing, mother of an Ithaca High School student, who shared her reaction.
I got the letter in the mail from the high school informing us that unless we responded to this letter, our son's name would be turned over to the military recruiters. Yes, I did have a conversation with him about the letter, and I've had conversations with his friends and his friends' parents, and they are, understandably, everyone is really concerned. So it's very important that parents respond to this. You're not given a self-addressed stamped envelope to do it in. You have to make sure that you assertively go out and do that if you don't want the military recruiters to get your kids' names.
If you did not receive a letter or if you have any questions, you should call the superintendent's office or Craig Evans at 274-2251. Letters are due back to your school office by March 7th.
Thanks to Emily Shumway for that report. Next, we hear from Lara Ratzlaff on this week's action at the Ithaca Taco Bell.
On Thursday, the 27th of February, a group of protesters gathered on Route 13 in front of Taco Bell to call attention to the low wages and poor working conditions of tomato pickers. The Ithaca protest was one of 100 across the United States taking place that day.
I'm here as a member of COLA, Cornell Organization for Labor Action. We want to draw some attention to Taco Bell and their exploitation of workers in South Florida. Taco Bell is refusing to come to the negotiating table with a group of workers in Immokalee, Florida. And I actually spent some time there a couple years ago, and I saw how bad the living conditions and working conditions were, and I really think it's important that people like us really make a point here to the public that this is a really wealthy company that's... They're in a position where they can change the conditions for these workers, and they're choosing not to.
We're trying to apply pressure to the packing company that actually employs these tomato workers, because Taco Bell buys 90% of their tomatoes, and basically in they're working in Florida, and they're making 40 to 45 cents for every 32 pounds of tomatoes, which is the same rate since 1978. They make well below the poverty level, and they live in substandard conditions. In the state of Florida, farm workers don't have the right to be in a union, so you don't have to recognize them.
Shame on you. Farm workers are people too.
We want them to come to the negotiating table to talk to these workers, to recognize their union, and to talk to them about raising their wages from $6,000 to $8,000 a year to something that they can live on.
For more information on this action, you can go to www.ciw-online.org. That's www.ciw-online.org.
Thanks, Laura, for that report. Next up, we have an opinion piece by Marty Luster, former assemblyman of the 125th District. He addresses the working conditions of agricultural laborers in New York State.
75 to 100 years ago, New York began to establish itself as the national leader in providing basic protections for its workforce. This state forged the way in providing health and safety regulations, unemployment insurance, mandatory overtime pay, workers' compensation, the minimum wage, child labor measures, and, above all, a guaranteed right to organize and bargain collectively. However, this proud history is being soiled by New York's failure to comprehensively address the plight of migrant labor within our borders. How can it be that decades after these basic protections were written into our law, one whole segment of our workforce has not yet been covered by most of these provisions? Those individuals and families who perform the arduous and exhausting work of bringing food to our tables, those who come here from other states and countries to work on our farms, our orchards, our vineyards, and our packing plants continue to be denied most of the basic protections that every other New York worker enjoys. Incredibly, it was only a few years ago that farm laborers were granted the right to have potable water supplied to them in the field. Even more recently, they were given the guarantee of field sanitary facilities. And now, finally, New York requires that agricultural workers be paid at least the same minimum wage that every other worker in New York State is entitled to receive. So, yes, there has been some progress, but it's now 2003, and New York still permits migrant workers, most often families, to be housed in substandard accommodations. There are no housing rules regarding the smallest migrant camps, while those that house more than five workers must only comply with the state's sanitary code, which provides for only a minimum of what most of us would call adequate living standards. New York also allows growers and processors to discriminate against farm laborers by denying them overtime pay after 8 hours of labor, and it fails to protect them from exposure to toxic chemicals and other environmental hazards, as are all other workers. But the discrimination doesn't end there. Every wage earner in this state is guaranteed the right to have one day off in every seven. All wage earners, that is, except for agricultural workers. Legislation to establish this right is regularly beaten back by the New York Farm Bureau, agribusiness's powerful lobby in Albany. The Farm Bureau argues that since agricultural workers are generally paid based on the volume of produce picked or processed, that most workers don't want to take time off in order to maximize earnings during a relatively short harvest period. However, the bill that has been repeatedly defeated simply gives the worker the right to take a day off. It doesn't mandate it. Nevertheless, the Farm Bureau's opposition continues, and the bill languishes year after year. Finally, New York law must be reformed to eliminate the near total lack of coverage for agricultural workers in the areas of unemployment insurance and workers' compensation. And, above all, these individuals must be given the same right to organize and collectively bargain as that enjoyed by every other segment of our workforce. Recent years have seen a growing awareness of these issues. Newspaper coverage of the plight of migrant labor has increased, and an increasing number of church, social action, and labor organizations have become vocal in their demands for change. It's late in the day, but not too late to enhance the quality of lives of those who come here to work hard, educate their children, and to enjoy a degree of dignity and respect that they, as hardworking and honest individuals, deserve. This is Martin Lester.
Last week, we aired the first part of our interview with Joan Beaucaire. We now turn to Kay Minix for the conclusion.
This is the second part of a two-part interview on the religious right with Ithaca resident Joan Beaucaire of Cornell Center for Religion, Ethics, and Social Policy. Last week, Joan led us through the rise of the religious right. She discussed how a group of conservative strategists grew the Republican Party and moved it to the far right. We heard about the various factions of the religious right. The premillennialists, who believe that nuclear war will hasten the return of Jesus Christ, and the Reconstructionists, who believe the United States should be ruled by the Ten Commandments and biblical law. This week, Joan Beaucaire talks about the takeover of government functions by churches. Last October, George Bush issued an executive order directing federal agencies to make tax dollars available to various religious organizations. Joan starts by talking about the pros and cons of these faith-based initiatives.
Okay, I'll start with the pros. I read a book by a man called Marvin Olasky, who is, by the way, a Reconstruction-influenced thinker. He's an elder in a Reconstruction sort of oriented church in Texas. And he's a professor of journalism at the University of Austin. He was a key political advisor to Bush. And he, in Texas, and he wrote a book called Compassionate Conservatism. And Bush wrote the foreword to the book. It came out in 2000. So he's had a lot of influence on Bush's thinking. And his book makes great reading. And he takes his son on a journey to all the poorest parts of the country. And over, the one charity that's being effective with the people who are most desperate and most destitute are the evangelical charities. They have had the greatest success rate with drug addicts, alcoholics. There are a lot of missions in throughout the world. They're doing some really good work. And his point in the book was, they're doing such great work, but none of them will touch government funding because it's so full of red tape, so full of requirements. But just think how well they would do if they had more money, if they're doing this well now. In Martin Olasky's book, he says that he thinks it's fine that these missions proselytize. He doesn't see any problem with that. Now imagine that you're really hungry, and in order to get a meal, you have to get saved or join a certain church. It's just ripe for manipulating people. There's another kind of manipulation that has happened, and that is that before the 2002 elections, there were some representatives who were, after redistricting, who were in trouble, some Republicans, a woman in the South in Kentucky, who was in a district that was now going to have a majority of African-American voters who tend to vote Democrat, and suddenly those churches are getting big grants from the Republican government. The use of this for political manipulation is just enormous. So it has a lot of dangers. Now, Congress was having a very hard time with this for a few reasons. I mean, they wanted to support it, basically. But first of all, they wanted to make sure that the money went to all religions. And the religious right did not want to give it to any but monotheistic religions. Islamic missions and Jewish missions were okay, but not Hindu or Buddhist. Or when they found out that some money would go to Hindu charities, they torpedoed the whole thing in Congress. They torpedoed it because those are satanic religions. So what did Bush do? He created, under the House and Human Services, a capital compassionate fund, $30 million, that department could just give out at its own discretion. So they did a whole end run around Congress. But there was still this, they were being sued because of this clause in the federal government's policies that said the federal government will not give money to agencies that discriminate in their hiring practices. So this is one of Bush's first acts in the new season was to remove that clause. So now the federal government can support agencies that discriminate.
In America today, we enjoy many freedoms unknown in most parts of the world. Religious freedom is one, the right to practice religion or no religion, as stated in the First Amendment. The debate over the separation of church and state is heating up, and the religious right is challenging the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
We have lived in an extraordinary time. I'm going back to 1947, when the Supreme Court declared there be a strong wall of separation between church and state. In 1962, when the Supreme Court declared that school prayer violated that separation. And we had a Supreme Court that fully supported the civil rights movement. A Supreme Court that gave us Roe versus Wade. We had an extraordinary group of people that sat on the Supreme Court in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, the Roosevelt Supreme Court. And we have enjoyed a level of liberty, a liberty for all people, because it's really the separation of church and state that gives everybody religious freedom. It's just key. There is a man that's having a huge influence. You know, if you ever doubt what one person can do, look at David Barton. This was a man, he's not a scholar, he's very limited in his understanding of issues. He was a salesman, but he's a good salesman. And what he's selling is the idea that the separation of church and state was a myth and that our founders never wanted it, really. And because it's not called for in the text of the Constitution, he has all these arguments that are really fallacious. I mean, really, just totally erroneous. He goes all over the country. He has light shows and all these really impressive shows and talks to huge crowds. And I think that he's done a huge amount of PR sort of at the grassroots level and giving people this idea that the separation of church and state is a myth. And that's what we're closest to losing. Scalia gave a talk last week criticizing the separation of church and state. And he's saying that if we're going to have a separation of church and state, it should come about democratically. What does that mean? Another constitutional convention? How are we going to democratically, I mean, in a country that's so polarized anyway, and where the religious right is so organized, He's clearly paving the way to revisit the separation of church and state.
In the last century, court rulings have changed the face of America. We now have laws on civil rights, anti-discrimination, environmental protections, reproductive rights, worker safety, minimum wages, and laws protecting the food we eat and the air we breathe. The 900 federal judges in this country, all life tenured, are responsible for deciding and protecting these laws and our constitutional rights. The Bush administration is moving quickly to fill the 90-plus vacancies in the federal judiciary. According to Ralph Nees, president of the People for the American Way, whoever gains control of the courts in the next 2 years will determine what the law of the land will be for several decades.
I guess what I watch most closely is what's happening in the courts. And I also want to point out that the political director for George Bush, his name is Karl Rove, is a master manipulator. And I feel in a lot of ways like we're all being manipulated by him. And I'm vehemently opposed to our going into Iraq, and I've been to an anti-war rally in D.C. But I just want people to keep their perspective, because while the opposition is very focused on Iraq, there's all this stuff going on internally that nobody's talking about. And the biggest issue are the judges. The appellate court judges are really important. I don't know if you're aware that something like 37,000 cases were decided in the appellate courts. It's where the precedent set, and the Supreme Court took less than 100 cases. This is last year. Those are really important appointments. The one that just got through, Michael McConnell, it's written a lot about his opposition to the separation of church and state. And any way that we can organize, whether it's getting our people in the Senate to filibuster, any way we can stop the appointment of those judges. Again, my biggest wish would be that moderate Republicans would switch parties the way Jeffers did. Do you know that when Jeffers left the Republican Party, the Democrats assumed the majority in the Senate, a one-seat majority, Bush's appointments suddenly stopped. They were going full steam ahead.
If you're interested in learning more about the religious right and its influences on American politics, Joan takes a minute to tell you about some watchdog organizations.
My favorite organization is Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. I think we should all be members. We should all be supporting them. And they have a wonderful magazine called Church and State. It is superb. Some of their writers are just excellent. People for the American Way is very well known, and they do really good work. The Interfaith Alliance, which is made up of several religious organizations opposing the religious right, Political Research Associates. If you do nothing else, read Church and State magazine and become a member of, or even start a local chapter.
Finally, Joan gives us her opinion on what might curtail the mounting influence of the religious right in government and what we can do.
If there are two groups of people I want to appeal to, one are moderate Republicans. How they manage to keep their moderates in line, I don't know. But my greatest hope, the one thing that could actually bring some sanity to our government is if the Republicans would leave the party, follow the example of Jim Jeffers and become Democrats. If the moderate Republicans understand what the religious right is really about and what they're trying to do, they would leave their party. And if two more senators would switch parties, that could save this country. It's that critical. And so it's moderate Republicans need to put pressure on their senators, let them know that they'll still be with them and support them if they switched. The other thing is for people to understand that whether we like it or not, we have a two-party system. And in a two-party system, third parties only give the votes to the party they're most opposed to. And someone who I think is just brilliant and has been a great hero of mine, I feel is responsible for giving us George Bush, and that's Ralph Nader. What Nader forced Gore to do was move to the swing voters and move away from the liberal part of the party. he was forced to appeal to those million swing voters who were in the middle, who loved their guns, loved the death penalty, things that he's opposed to. He had to try to appeal to those people. He had to campaign really hard in states that would have normally been shoo-ins, states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Washington, Oregon. He worked really hard in those states, so instead of campaigning in Ohio, where he should have been, or Florida. So the Nader's candidacy was just a disaster. And I hope he, you know, I don't necessarily want him to run around beating his chest and saying mea culpa, but I sure don't want him to keep doing this. You know, the Greens challenged Democrats in 10 key elections in 2002, including Wellstone in Minnesota. They were making it really hard for Wellstone. So it's time to wake up to where this divisiveness is taking us. And the Democrats aren't everything, and they're not all we want them to be. But look at where we're heading if they don't get back in the leadership of government.
You've been listening to an interview with Joan Beaucaire of Cornell Center for Religion, Ethics, and Social Policy. You can visit her website for more information about the religious right at www.4religious-right.info. That's www.4religious-right.info.
That was Kay Minix with Joan Beaucaire. Here are some upcoming events in the area. International Women's Day celebrations locally include a performance by singer, songwriter, and guitarist Faith Nolan tonight at 7 p.m. in Hobart and William Smith College's library. Tonight at 8 p.m., Ithaca artists join groups from over 800 communities worldwide in a reading of Carolyn Balducci's hilarious and topical adaptation of Lysistrata, telling the story of women from opposing states who unite to end a war by withholding sex until the men agree to lay down their swords. The reading begins at 8 p.m. tonight at Autumn Leaves on the Ithaca Commons. March 8th is International Women's Day. In Washington, D.C., thousands of women and men join a women-led peace convergence to encircle the White House. Join with Alice Walker, comedian Janine Garofalo, Dr. Helen Caldicott, Granny D., Barbara Ehrenreich, Medea Benjamin, Starhawk, and many others for the rally beginning at 11 a.m. For more information on this and other upcoming actions for peace, go to www.unitedforpeace.org. Wednesday at 7 p.m., the Sierra Club Movie Night presents two short films, Overuse of Antibiotics in Animals, a Human Health Threat, and This Land is Your Land, documenting a century of national forest management. That's at 7 p.m. in the Old Jailhouse, 125 East Court Street in Ithaca. Movie night is free and open to the public. Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi and founder of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, is the keynote speaker in this year's Cornell Tradition Convocation. That's 7:30 Thursday evening in the Statler Auditorium. The event is free and open to the public, but tickets are required and can be obtained at the Cornell Public Service Center or by calling 255-8595. Sing along for peace with local acoustic bands, Jamtima and Akashic Wind, at the C-Spot Gallery on the Ithaca Commons this Friday beginning at 8:30 p.m. Finally, we have a heads-up for next Monday evening's debate between Nadine Strossen of the American Civil Liberties Union and Pat Buchanan, 2002 presidential candidate, about the state of civil liberties after 9/11. That's 8 p.m. in Bailey Hall on the Cornell campus. Tickets are $15 and are available through the Willard Strait box office. Call 255-7132 for more information.
The theme music in tonight's show is an instrumental version of Circus by Crow Greenspun. During the show, we played an excerpt of Hold On by Hank Roberts.
This week's show was produced by Jeff Kirby and Jesse Lind, with help from Kay Minix, Lara Ratzloff, and Emily Shumway. I'm your host, John Illingworth. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week.
The Ithaca Radio Hour is looking for producers. If you're interested in producing a local story, email info@ithacaradio.org or call and leave a message at 607-273-0532. We hold open meetings the second Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. at Autumn Leaves Used Bookstore on the Ithaca Commons. The Ithaca Radio Hour is a project of Ithaca Community Radio and is produced at Rep Studio. For more information about ICR, visit our website at www.ithacaradio.org. You're listening to WEOS 89.7 Geneva, and rebroadcast in Ithaca by Ithaca Community Radio on 88.1.